From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, Wynton Marsalis announced he was breaking up his septet to devote his energies to running Lincoln Center's jazz program. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis about his life, his music, and his controversial jazz program at Lincoln Center. And critic Maureen Carrigan picks the year's best books. She thinks these books might make good holiday gifts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan said today the U.S. economy is solid, but he warned the Joint Economic Committee of Congress against letting those good conditions fuel inflation. Greenspan did not say whether the Fed is likely to raise interest rates again soon, but sounded like the Fed is ready to act again if necessary.
We must remain alert to signs of inflationary pressures on resources. If we allow these to develop, resources will begin to be used less efficiently, productivity improvements will be harder to find, and firms will be more disposed to raise prices.
Greenspan made his comments after lawmakers urged him not to raise interest rates further. NATO decided today to ask its member states how many troops they might supply if the alliance has to help evacuate UN peacekeepers from Bosnia. France says it has asked the UN and NATO to make plans to withdraw the peacekeeping troops because diplomatic efforts are making no progress. The difficulty in evacuating troops can be seen in the current attempt to withdraw a group of Bangladeshi soldiers from the besieged enclave of Bihach. The BBC's Martin Dawes explains.
The Bangladeshis are in parlous state, really. They were deployed early into the pocket. It wasn't their fault. They have, we're told, one rifle between some four or five soldiers. They're sharing sleeping bags. I mean, obviously, I think the minimum requirement that the UN is trying to do is get it to a situation where they have one soldier, one gun, and one soldier to a sleeping bag.
Martin Dawes in Sarajevo. The Michigan Senate has passed a ban on assisted suicide to replace a temporary ban that expired last month. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The legislation, which still needs the approval of the Michigan House, passed by a 3-1 margin in the state Senate. Its sponsor, Republican Fred Dillingham, makes it clear that the measure is aimed at one person, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who since 1990 has been present at 21 suicides, the most recent taking place over the Thanksgiving weekend. Senate passage of the bill comes despite public opinion polls showing Michigan residents in favor of allowing some form of assisted suicide for terminally ill patients. Dr. Kevorkian's attorney called lawmakers who voted for the ban religious fanatics. The Michigan Supreme Court is already considering the constitutionality of the now expired temporary ban on assisted suicide. It's likely that any new law would also face a court challenge. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The Labor Department says productivity was up 2.9% in the third quarter with no increase in unit labor costs. The improvement in productivity more than makes up for a drop of 2.1% in the second quarter. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 16 points in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is down nearly 7. This is NPR News. The Justice Department says the former White House Travel Office director has been charged with embezzlement. The department says a federal grand jury has returned a 2-count indictment against Billy Dale. It alleges that Dale wrongfully converted to his own use $68,000 that had been paid to the Travel Office by the news media for their reporters to travel with the president. Dale's attorney has said his client will plead not guilty. A winter storm has dumped more than a foot of snow in some parts of the Midwest. In Iowa, some city officials say they're way behind in trying to dig out. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports from Des Moines.
Heavy snow and freezing rain blanketed Midwest towns, mostly in Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska. U.S. Interstates 29, 35, and 80, which run through the Midwest, have been 100% snow and ice covered. The winter weather has been blamed for at least one death in a traffic accident and for the partial collapse of a domed sports arena in northeast Iowa. In Des Moines, every piece of snow equipment the city has is in use, and officials say it will take at least a day to get the snow cleared, just in time for another storm. Forecasters expect more snow across the region for the rest of the week. The weather across the Midwest has been fairly mild until now. Just last week, temperatures were as much as 20 degrees above normal. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
A tank filled with natural gas exploded under a city park in Seoul, South Korea today. Police say the explosion killed four people and injured more than 40. Four other people are reported missing. Authorities say the explosion caused a fire that destroyed about 50 houses. The gas tank, owned by a state-run company, supplied fuel for cooking and heating to thousands of homes. Police say they don't know what caused the explosion, but that six people were working on the tank when it blew up. I'm Barbara Campbell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brothers Branford and Wynton Marsalis are making big changes in their lives. Saxophonist Branford Marsalis recently announced he's going to leave The Tonight Show. He's directed the band since Jay Leno took over. And last week, trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis announced he was breaking up his band. He organized the septet 7 years ago. Wynton Marsalis is my guest, and he says the timing of these two changes is just a coincidence. Wynton Marsalis used to be the best-known jazz musician of his generation. He still is, but he's also now, at the age of 33, one of the best-known living jazz musicians in the world. As the director of Lincoln Center's jazz program, he's also a figure of controversy. Wynton Marsalis joined Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers when he was still a teenager. He later became the first musician to win Grammy Awards for classical and jazz recordings in the same year. Now he has a new book called Sweet Swing Blues on the Road. Before we meet him, let's hear his composition Hustle Bustle from his album City Movement. Decide to leave the road?
Well, I just felt that the band that we had assembled had run its course creatively. Like, we reached a point where we weren't going to be able to move forward on what our original vision that we had embarked upon. And also, I wanted to spend more time and concentrate on jazz at Lincoln Center and try to really build the program. And I feel like I needed more time off to really execute my duties as the artistic director with more clarity.
Was this a collective decision with the other members of the band, or is it a decision that you made?
Well, I made the decision, but I think all the guys agreed with it. And we know we'll get together and we'll always be playing with each other because we've known each other for 20 years in a lot of cases. So and a lot of the musicians in the band who were younger than me, I have a stake in their development. So I will support them anyway, and we see each other all the time.
Now, your father, Ellis Marsalis, the pianist, I believe he was not on the road very much. He played mostly in New Orleans. Was that by choice or by necessity?
I think it was mainly by necessity. It was hard for him. It's hard to get gigs first playing jazz music. And he was struggling in New Orleans, so I'm sure if he had the choice, he wouldn't have chosen to stay in the city with five or six children and try to make it, you know, eking out a living as a local jazz musician. That was hard for him.
So he would have preferred to be on the road?
just any way to play and make more money than he was making to support his family more. I'm sure he would have preferred that.
Did that discourage you from becoming a jazz musician?
No, because, you know, my daddy loved the music. And I remember asking him once when he had, like, was down to his last gig, and he was contemplating driving a cab or getting some type of day job, whether he regretted playing jazz because, you know, nobody really liked to hear that kind of music. And he said no. And he was very emphatic about how much he loved the music, and I had defined a lot of his adulthood and put things in focus for him. And, you know, then I was like 13 or 14, so I really, the philosophical implications of what he was saying, I didn't really care too much about that. I just wanted to know if it was yes or no. And he was fortunate in that my mother always supported him as a musician. And she would complain about the fact that we didn't have money, but she always wanted him to play music. She didn't. She was never pushing him to get a day job or say, well, you know, you shouldn't have played this music. She was always behind him as a musician.
It's probably going to be hard for a lot of people to understand how a pianist or any jazz musician can go without working in New Orleans, but I guess a lot of the New Orleans music that paid was a traditional tourist-oriented jazz.
Right. Well, my father
Dixieland.
We just call it New Orleans music. And New Orleans musicians hate to be called Dixieland musicians.
No, but I mean the commercialization of right. New Orleans music. That's probably what there were more jobs for.
Yeah, and my father played a traditional job for a while with the Storyville Jazz Band. They played in a club called Crazy Shirley's.
Mm-hmm.
But then when that gig ended, he really was a modern jazz musician. So, you know, he had a very, very hard time trying to play, like, music that came out of, not bebop, but the whatever. They never really invented a term for the style that they were playing. But it's post-bebop type of music. It just the audience wasn't there for that.
Wynton Marsalis is my guest, and he has a new book called Sweet Swing Blues on the Road. At what point in your life did you realize that you had crossed a threshold and you were no longer that brilliant young jazz musician, that you were a man, you know what I mean, that you weren't going to be applauded anymore for being talented at this very young age? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I don't really know because I was 19 for like 10 years. So, you know, I was called like the 19-year-old trumpet player. I was 27, and they were still saying the 19-year-old trumpet player. So, I mean, I'm 33 now, and I still have people saying, well, you know, a lot of cats think that you haven't been out here, and you shouldn't be saying, well, hold on a second, I've been out here for 15 years now. So I don't really know when that point came, because, I've always been serious. I always wanted to be a man. When I was a kid, I never wanted to be like a child. I had fun. I played ball and, you know, clown with my friends. But I always liked hanging with my father and all the jazz musicians. And it seemed like I've been around older musicians my whole life. I was always the youngest in every band. And I like the young musicians, but I'm not trying to act like a kid when I'm around them. I'm generally trying to tell them what I learned from the older musicians. And so maturity in adulthood is something that I've always embraced. And the older I get, the younger I act. So I don't really, that type of transition of being the young this and the young that, I never put any stock or faith in that.
When you say the older you get, the younger you act, do you mean that there's no longer this burden on you to act mature since you already are mature?
Well, I've always strived, my whole philosophy has been to embrace adulthood. So the older I get, just the more comfortable I am.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not that much different from all of my friends.
This burden of being mature, was that because you were playing at such a young age with older musicians?
No, I just like to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't even so much a burden because I could always clown. And, you know, when you can talk or you can tease or rib, we call it ribbing, you know, in New Orleans, or when you can tell all the nasty jokes, or when you a good cursor, or you can play ball or something, you get along with all of your friends. So I've never been in that position of being like the artist who's left out, and because my artistic aspirations, I never really shared that with my friends, the guys that I grew up with. And if they were interested in it, yeah, I would tell them about it. But most of the people I knew really were not interested in jazz music or what I was playing. So we would just play ball or talk about whatever.
So what was it like for you to grow up interested in a music that none of your other friends were particularly interested in?
Well, I mean, it was fine with me because it gave me something that I felt distinguished me from my partners. I mean, they kind of knew, yeah, I went play the trumpet, and They knew, because I had an article written on me in the newspaper when I was like 14 or 15 in New Orleans. So it gave me like a little reputation or something. But nobody ever knew for what. And Branford and I played in funk bands, really. So we were always a part of our generation also.
But there must have come a point for you where you wanted to play with other people your own age and play jazz. Was it ever hard to find other people your age to play with?
Yeah, it's always been hard.
It's still hard?
It's always hard to find people who really, really want to play and pay the dues that are required to play and to maintain their seriousness for a long time.
I imagine it's harder now to find jazz musicians than it would have been, say, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, I imagine it's harder for you than it would have been, say, for Sonny Rollins.
Yeah, it's harder because most of the musicians that I find, I have to be the one to show them about what jazz is. Like, a lot of times, it'll be musicians I met in a clinic when they were 13 or 14 and had my little brother Delphio to send them albums. Like, you can be sure that Philly Joe Jones wasn't playing jazz because of Miles Davis. Or Sam Woodyard played jazz because Duke Ellington. He had the opportunity to play in Duke's band. I'm sure he loved Duke Ellington and his music. But then there were more musicians who were playing. It was more of a field. Jerry Mulligan, I did an interview with him, and he was telling me in Philadelphia, when he was growing up, there were all kind of radio bands, and there were a lot of jobs for musicians. So if you wanted to be an arranger, you had a lot of examples. But now I'll say that 30 or 40 years ago, yes, there would have been more musicians, but let's say there are more musicians now to choose from than there was 15 years ago when I first came to New York.
Is this why you spend so much time teaching classes and doing concerts in which you bring young people from the city that you're in onto the bandstand with you?
Yeah, that's very important, to invite the youngsters into the music. But it also is because it's fun. You see, a lot of times when you're talking about something in public, unless you're telling stories, it's very difficult to convey to people really the fun of it, because it always seems like it's some just a philosophical debate about jazz and pop music or, you know, but that's not really what goes on.
My guest is trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. Let's hear his solo on his composition, The Death of Jazz, from his album, The Majesty of the Blues. Wynton Marsalis from his album, The Majesty of the Blues. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. He has a new book called Sweet Swing Blues on the Road. What was it like at home when you were growing up? What was your home life like? What was the neighborhood like, atmosphere in the family?
Well, I'll tell you about my block that we lived on Webster Street. We lived on the side of the railroad tracks that the black people lived on. It was in Kendall, Louisiana, a southern town. They have ditches in the street where the sewage, the ditches dug out. some black asphalt streets we play street football in. The sweet shop around the corner where they sell those pigtails and pig feet in a little red jar and Mary Jane candies and all of that. The gym down the street where we would all play. They had three black Little League football teams, Morgan, Pellerin, and Pollock. And they had about 10 white teams like Wentwood and Driftwood, and we would play them. The people next door to me on the left, once the guy, his wife shot him in the foot. The guy across the street from me, his daughter was pregnant by him. They had a woman used to walk up and down the street named Geraldine, who was crazy. She would be hitting people with switches and stuff, so we would run from her. We were scared of her. There was a woman who lived down the street in a yellow house who killed her husband on the Easter Sunday and shot him. They had a guy named William. He would be out in the street fighting with his wife. He would get drunk and whip her booty on a regular basis. A lot of people would be disillusioned because they weren't working and they were having a hard time struggling. Then they had another house where the dope man would live. He would be selling the dope to the people in the community. The railroad tracks, the train, sometimes you could hop the train and go like a mile down the way in the black section. There was one white lady who lived three blocks away. They used to call her Old Lady Witch because she got caught there in that section for some reason. So she would always come out on the porch and, you know, if you'd be driving by, like on your bicycle or something, we used to tease her. She'd come out and start talking about niggas in her neighborhood and all kind of crazy stuff.
So did it seem unusual to have a well-balanced family like yours?
Well, our family wasn't necessarily well-balanced.
Oh, okay.
See, we were struggling with dealing with life like everybody else. We weren't that different from other people in our neighborhood. And then my little brother was autistic in Boyer, and he was born. I was 9 years old, and this was like in 1970. So he, our family like wasn't based on playing music and all this. My father was a struggling musician who was trying to deal with his responsibilities to feed his family. And he and my mother both had a great disillusionment because even though they had grown up in segregation and they were happy because of integration and the breakdown of all these riding in the back of streetcars and stuff, the progress in the society wasn't the way they thought it would be. So this was right in the age when they started to dawn on them that their lives were going to fall into a certain pattern. So they were having to deal with that. And my mother was really dealing with the trauma of my little brother being autistic and how was she going to get help for him. And, you know, my brothers, we would be fighting constantly. We had a good time, though. Now, I'm describing our neighbor because we had a lot of things. But we thought these things were normal. I mean, we knew somebody getting killed wasn't normal. But, like, we also had the Bossy Clay's gas station where you could work and you could go, you know, the gasoline then was like 35 cents a gallon. We had Burton's Pharmacy, which was across from there, where you could go in and try to steal you a little something. And the Clay's Church, where Reverend Clay had about 23 children. And it was a certain type of life that it's never been communicated whenever my family has talked about it. It's always like, yes, and we sat around and Daddy played jazz and Mommy did something and then the kids pulled their horns out. We didn't grow up that way at all. I mean, you'd have to... You go out in the street and you would have to put your foot into some booty. You know, you had to deal with what everybody else was dealing with.
But was it hard for you to hold your own in a situation like that? Did being a musician help you at all, help your standing in the neighborhood?
No, well, I wasn't really a musician. They knew me for being able to catch them touchdown passes and shooting that jump shot.
Oh.
See, you didn't, I mean, nobody really liked that kind of music. Mainly, you know, you'd be in the community, like what's going on with Beyond, you know, Marvin Gaye. And we have like our little house parties at Sean Jones's house. It was like typical Southern life for the American Negro at that time.
What impact did it have on you when your brother Amboyo was born and he was autistic? Did you spend a lot of time taking care of him? Did you feel that it limited any of your options because you had to bear more responsibility for the family?
No, you know, I didn't. It didn't really have that much of an impact on me because I was so deeply into what I was doing. That the fact that he was autistic, I used to tease my mother all the time and say, something's wrong with that boy. You know, just like teasing him. I didn't know, but he would be kind of strange to me, you know. But then I was 9, 10, 11, you know, a lot of stuff was going on in our house. And then when we found out that he was autistic, we had no idea of what that meant. You see, we were country people. So they say, well, he's autistic. We were like, good. That means he can draw or something. And then he would be hitting his head. You know, he had like a lot of these traits because he's severely autistic. And at one point, my little brother could talk, and then he stopped talking. I can still remember he used to say, get off the table, man. That was like his little thing. And then he stopped talking altogether. And then he just withdrew into this way of being, the way he's still that way now. And, you know, I remember in my neighborhood, there was a family of boys, all boys. And they were all like gangsters. Like, you know, everybody in the neighborhood was kind of scared of them. But Earl, which was the oldest brother, he taught me how to play basketball. So we were real good friends. And Jack, he was the roughest of all the brothers. Like, this was the type of guy who eventually all of these brothers got killed except for Earl. And I saw Earl later. He said, man, Jack died. Well, me and Jack, we were really tight. But Jack was the type of guy who was just real, real hard, and he very seldom would show emotion. But I remember one day when I was like 11 years old, I was sitting out on the street with my bicycle. I was 12, and me and Jack and I, we were talking. He said, man, where's your little brother, the one that's crazy? I said, my little brother's not crazy, man. He's autistic. He said, man, let me tell you something. If I had a brother like that, I would have him on my bike right now, and I would take him all around this city. So, like, that was something, it was a certain emotion that came out of him that I didn't expect. And to be honest, I never have had that type of relationship with my little brother, like, where I really would take him around. Mm-hmm. Because we were always running up and down. And if you take my little brother out, you know, he would, when he was younger, you never knew what reaction he would have to being in different circumstances.
Does he still live at home with your parents?
Yes, he still lives at home.
Wynton Marsalis is my guest, and he has a new book. It's called Sweet Swing, Blues on the Road. Why did trumpet become your instrument when you did start to play?
Well, that's the instrument that I had, because my father had gotten a trumpet. Al Hurt gave me a trumpet on my 6th birthday. And I didn't play it that much because I wasn't serious about it. But once I became serious, you know, I already had the instrument, so I didn't mind playing it.
So the music you heard around you, heard the contemporary music that your father was playing, and there was the pop music on the radio. What else was around you?
Well, once I became a musician?
No, when you were young, when you were just starting out.
Well, we had all of those kind of little Walt Disney things of like symphony music, but I didn't really like any of that. Mm-hmm. And then when Walter Cronkite was on the news, they'd play that Beethoven. Boom, boom. I mean, I can remember hearing
that.
Yeah, I always liked that. So even to this day, and then once I started to learn in high school about Beethoven, he was my favorite composer, and even now I love his music. And I can remember just as a baby hearing that theme. And mainly it was pop music that we heard: James Brown, Marvin Gaye, Stevie, and Sam and Dave. We lived next to a barroom in a restaurant pool hall. And before we moved to Kendall, we lived in a place called Hanson City, Louisiana. And there was a woman named Miss Mary who had like two of the biggest breasts you ever saw in your life. So I used to like to always lay up underneath her. And she liked to fix me shrimp, boiled shrimp, you know. And in Louisiana, they have the boiled shrimp that you like to eat. So I can always remember they always had like some Sam and Dave on the radio. On the jukebox. And you know, when you're a kid and you walk into a ballroom, like those ballrooms with the black and red tile, mm-hmm. real country where they serve fried catfish and stuff, you always had that smell of beer. It was like in a place you didn't think you were supposed to be. So since we lived next door to them and sometimes they would babysit us, I would go there in the daytime and I can remember the music that they played on the jukebox.
My guest is Wynton Marsalis. He has a new book called Sweet Swing, Blues on the Road. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Wynton Marsalis will be back with us on the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. We'll find out why he's become perhaps the most controversial jazz musician of his generation. Also, get out your pen and paper. Critic Maureen Corrigan has some suggestions for the bookworms on your holiday shopping list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A former director of the White House Travel Office has been indicted on embezzlement charges. UPI's Bill Small reports.
A grand jury has indicted former White House Travel Office Director Billy Ray Dale on charges he embezzled some $68,000 from money paid by news organizations for travel with the president. Dale has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing. He had worked in the travel office for some 30 years and ran it from 1982 until last year, when he and six other travel office employees were fired after allegations of mismanagement from Clinton associates and a distant cousin of Mr. Clinton's who had proposed herself for Dale's job. The White House has admitted mishandling that investigation, and five of the employees have received other jobs. Congressional Republicans have promised a hearing on the matter. Bill Small at the White House.
The Michigan Senate has voted overwhelmingly to make a ban on assisted suicide permanent. The state House has not voted on the measure yet. Lawmakers have said they want to keep Dr. Jack Kevorkian from attending any more suicides before the Michigan Supreme Court rules on the issue. The New York City Council filed suit against Mayor Rudolph Giuliani in state Supreme Court today to resolve a fight over the city's budget. NPR's Melissa Block reports from New York.
The mayor and the council have been at odds for weeks, wrangling over how to close a $1 billion budget gap. The council rejected the mayor's proposed cuts. The mayor then vetoed the council's alternative plan and imposed his own cuts unilaterally. With negotiations at an impasse, the council is asking the court to rule on who has the final authority under the 1989 city charter, the mayor or the council. City Council Speaker Peter Vallone.
That is the main question that started this country several hundred years ago. Government must be balanced. There must be a clear separation of powers. And when there's a dispute, we learn not to go to war, but to go to court.
Vallone added, no one is above the law. The case will be argued in court next Thursday. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan gave an upbeat assessment of the economy today, but warned the Joint Economic Committee of Congress that inflation still bears watching. Greenspan did not say whether the Fed is likely to raise interest rates again soon, but sounded like the Fed is ready to act again if necessary. The International Energy Agency says oil production is surging and should average at least 1.1 million barrels per day for the fourth quarter. Analysts say ample supplies, including refined products like gasoline and heating oil, should keep prices low, especially if the winter is mild. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 10 points to close at 3735.52. Declining issues led advances by a 2-to-1 margin in heavy trading. The Nasdaq closed down 7 points. This is NPR. Defense Secretary William Perry says the U.S. has not lost credibility by refusing to send troops to Bosnia. Perry said in a speech to a private Mideast policy group that Bosnia presents no vital national security interest to the United States, unlike the Persian Gulf, where the U.S. did send troops to fight Iraq. Perry said the U.S. should not rattle its saber during every difficult situation, but should be prepared to fight when American vital interests are threatened. Mexico's southern state of Chiapas may be on the brink of war after an 11-month ceasefire. Zapatista rebels there say they will break the peace if a member of the ruling party is sworn in tomorrow as governor of that state. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
The Zapatistas' main spokesman, known as Subcommander Marcos, says he and the Mayan rebels he leads will go to war if the ruling PRI party's Eduardo Robledo becomes the governor of Chiapas. Robledo's election in August has been widely questioned due to charges of rigged voting by the ruling party. He is due to be sworn in tomorrow. Last night, Robledo said he would resign as governor if the Zapatista rebels laid down their arms. Ernesto Cedillo, who took office last week as Mexico's new president, says the government will refrain from the use of violence in Chiapas, but he also says authorities will not knuckle under to the Zapatistas' demands. The rebels are demanding that a leftist gubernatorial candidate, who officially got 35% of the votes, be installed as governor. I'm David Wellna in Mexico City.
The annual report on the price of the gifts in the song The 12 Days of Christmas says the cost of the package rose by less than the inflation rate this year. That's about 3%. PNC Bank Corporation says the total comes to $15,944.20, up 1.6% from last year. The biggest price increase in the list was for 5 gold rings. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. Last week, he announced he was breaking up his band to devote more time to his work directing the jazz program at Lincoln Center. Marsalis has a new book called Sweet Swing Blues on the Road. Before we talk some more, let's hear his recording of Cherokee from his album Standard Time, Volume 1. As a young man, you both went to Juilliard and played with Art Blakey's band. Did you get two really different approaches to music between Juilliard and Blakey?
Well, the style of Art Blakey's teaching is the style of the jazz musician. I grew up with that because that's how my father is. Real natural musicianship, and you just learn by, like Blaney used to always tell you, shut up and listen and learn.
Mm-hmm.
Like his vibration was you observe and you learn. And at Juilliard, it'd be like some theory classes and stuff. And I was at Juilliard for 1 year. But, you know, I never separated the two ways of learning. Like, sometimes you get your booty whip and you learn from that way. And sometimes you go and you study and you learn that way. It's like if you play basketball, whenever somebody comes on the court who's been coached a little bit, they almost always beat people who play on the street.
Was there a period in your life where you weren't sure whether you'd become a classical musician or a jazz musician?
No, I always wanted to be a jazz musician. I didn't know whether you could make it playing jazz, like, because I never wanted to be famous. I just wanted to be like my father. I figured if I could just make enough to live and survive. And I knew people could work playing classical music. But I always, in jazz, to think that you could be a jazz musician in the 1970s was crazy because nobody really was playing it. And the one thing I always knew that the music we were playing that we called jazz was not really jazz. Because my brother and I, we would play what we call jazz. It was like fusion.
Mm-hmm.
But what my father would be playing, we would call that old jazz. But I would always be telling my brother and them, man, daddy and them, they playing jazz. What we playing, that's like what we play with creators, which was funk music.
Mm-hmm.
So I always wanted to be a real jazz musician. But it was hard to figure out how you could learn how to play. So once I had the opportunity to play with Art Blakey, that was the first time I really could see, well, damn, you know, maybe I could learn how to play jazz.
Art Blakey's band was really much more about blowing than it was about composition. You've grown into being, I think, a really good composer, and you're working more and more with larger groups so that you can compose for them. But, you know, early on in your career, it must have been much more about soloing than about composition.
Yeah, it was about soloing because I didn't know a lot about the history of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the only thing of playing jazz was to play a solo. And the conception of group improvisation and listening to the band, and you see, it's always important. Like, I'm from the 1970s generation, so little things like we always played with monitors We always played with electronic instruments. They always were playing much louder than the horns. We never played with drummers who knew how to play soft or control their instruments. We didn't play blues-based music unless you grew up in the church, and even a lot of the church music by that time was influenced by popular music, so it didn't have the same potent quality that the earlier church music had. Our objectives as jazz musicians were not to make coherent musical statements in the context of a solo, but to thrill the audience like what you do in fusion music. So when I met Stanley Crouch, this was when I was like, excuse me.
This is Stanley Crouch, the music critic who works with you also at Lincoln Center.
Right. I met him, I was 17 years old, and I went to his house. He had all kind of books and albums, and he was talking about jazz and the history of jazz and how you should know Ornette Coleman's music and how you should know Duke Ellington's music. Well, even though my father was from that same school, you know, a lot of times you don't listen to somebody just because they're your father or because it's your parent. Well, when I met Crouch, it was the first time I had seen somebody who wasn't corny, who was like the type of cast that I grew up with, but who was a very serious intellectual. So he opened my eyes to the importance of studying and understanding jazz as an art form. And also he introduced me to Mr. Albert Murray, who wrote the book Stompin' the Blues. And this book was instrumental in opening my eyes to the objectives of a jazz musician. Whereas before then, I had never had that clearly articulated to me. You know, I just felt if you had some ability, you played. And if the people liked what you were playing, you were good.
Wynton Marsalis is my guest. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with composer and trumpet player Wynton Marsalis. You are the artistic director now at the Lincoln Center Jazz Program, and you commission works and also do a lot of jazz repertory. And you've been at the center of this controversy for some time over the work that you're representing in the program. You've been criticized by some jazz critics for being too narrow in your definition of jazz and not representing more experimental players within the jazz repertory programs like Mujal Richard Abrams, the Art Ensemble of Chicago, Anthony Braxton. Why don't you represent more?
First, because they say they don't play jazz. That's the first reason.
And of course, a lot of players have said that they don't play jazz.
But the second reason is I agree with them.
Okay.
I've played that music. And the music that I'm interested in playing is that which I think will teach students how to play the blues and how to swing. Now, I'm the artistic director, so the program functions on my vision. I have to present a vision that is consistent with what I believe. Now, by the same token, I'm not trying to stop anyone else from hiring these men. And I will go to hear them play and will enjoy some of what they play. But I don't feel that they represent... First, I don't feel that most of what they're playing is jazz, so I don't feel obligated to present it at Jazz at Lincoln Center. I've had Mujal Richard Abrams come and play, Don Byron, and I've played with Lester Bowie's band, I've played with David Murray, and I still say that I don't feel that what they play is jazz music. And on one hand, they say they're not playing jazz, and then when it's something like Jazz at Lincoln Center, then they won't say, well, we are playing jazz. A lot of what they play sounds like classical music to me.
Well, let me just quote the Village Voice music critic Gary Giddens. He wrote about you earlier this year. How did Wynton Marsalis, that radiant teenage trumpeter of Blakey's Album of the Year, become at age 32 the kind of finicky scold who's reducing jazz to a cause that recalls family values?
The first thing is that I would like to say publicly is I'm ready to meet Gary Giddens at any time to give him the type of intellectual and verbal spanking that he deserves. That's number one. Number two is what made him an authority on anything. He can't play anything. I've never heard him. You never see him in the clubs. You never see him listening to any musicians. He's not engaged with anything. He just sits up somewhere and writes articles about me scolding people. I'm not scolding anybody. I'm presenting a vision and a viewpoint on what I feel jazz is as the artistic director of jazz at Lincoln Center.
Are you in any way enjoying the controversy? And do
yes.
you think that, you know, since so few people pay attention to jazz, that it's maybe exciting for you to have this like big issue that's being debated, that there's a cause of controversy?
Yes, I like getting into an open dialogue and debate with the jazz critical community because I feel that they have an authority which is unearned. And I'm ready to prove that at any time. I feel that. I believe it with all my heart and soul. And I think that it's great that we have the chance to have a public dialogue. And I feel more than happy and willing to use my publicity to expose them.
But Whitten, you know, you're two of the people who have been closest and most influential to you, Stanley Crouch and Albert Murray. They're both writers. They're both,
yes,
in their own way critics. So you can't just generically write off all music critics.
But I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not the ones who disagree with you. I mean, no, it's not that they disagree with me. I said I feel that they have an authority which is far greater than what their knowledge. I play classical music, right?
Yeah,
I don't have
right.
a problem with someone criticizing music. That's an important function. My problem with Garrigan's is not that he says I can't play or that he doesn't like my records. He should do that. It's not mandatory for you to like somebody's music. What I don't like is they step into the social arena. They talk about people's family background. They say all kind of things that they don't know what they're talking about. And then their philosophies are what the philosophies of these men are being used to teach students how to play. Now, when you go to Juilliard, you're going to study counterpoint. What some critic thought about box music is of no significance whatsoever. The music is the issue. In jazz music, the music is fifth or sixth. And most of the interviews I do with jazz critics, we get to music somewhere way down the road. Most of the time it's a question of what did I think about Miles Davis's hairstyle or my brother going to play with Sting? What do I think about rap music? I'm not a rap musician. What do I know about rap? If I tell you I don't like it, then I have to talk for 15 minutes about not liking it. Like, it's a crime to not like a thing. It's not a crime for Gary Ginnis to not like my music or for any of these jazz critics. What is criminal is the fact that most of the time in discourse, the space, this a conduit from the musician to the public is spent with trivial issues, backbiting, and stuff that's of no significance. It's poorly reported. It has no respect for the musicians, and when you try to call them out, they don't want to meet you in public and have a discourse. I don't want to beat any men up or meet them in an alley and hit them with bats. I just want to have a public, fair public discourse on issues that are concerning jazz music.
When you were coming of age musically, what was the avant-garde like, and what were your impressions of the avant-garde then?
I went to the very first concert of the World Saxophone Quartet at the Southern University in New Orleans that was put on by Kid Jordan. We used to go to Southern University in New Orleans every Saturday and make noise for 2 hours. Now, it was fun, but in no way did I ever consider that to be jazz music. I love Kid Jordan. He's like my uncle. We're all tight, and he was a firm exponent of the avant-garde jazz. He booked the first World Saxophone Quartet concert. We are like a family. I mean, Kid, his son Kent Jordan, who's a flautist, was the one who made me serious about practicing. And we would go every Saturday and play, blah, 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 play songs that Alvin Batiste wrote, who also was like my uncle. And we would have like long, resounding debates about this music. And I believe then, and then I was only 12 or 13, that music was not jazz music. And I believe it now. It is not jazz music. It's fun to play. It's a good tool for teaching students how to get to some expression because you can play what you want. But to me, it's like when you go out on a basketball court and you have some people who are trying to learn how to play and you tell them, man, just dribble and shoot at any goal you can. That's fun and it's a good way to learn, but you ain't gonna pay to see Michael Jordan do that or to see the National Basketball Association. They just get out on the court and just start running all into the stands and just shooting at any goal. They have rules and guidelines, and jazz musicians have objectives.
I have one last question for you. While we were waiting for all the mics to get turned on and everything, I actually overheard you doing a lot of mouth sounds.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wondering if you'd do that. What was that? Exactly. Is that good to warm up? I mean, do you actually do that for a function as well as just for fun?
Mm-mm, this is what's good to warm up. It's called the buzz.
Right.
And it has many, many functions.
It gets the muscles loosened up?
Muscles and other things.
It's kind of like being your own mouthpiece.
Well, yes, it's a very useful tool for all trumpeters.
Well, Wynton Marsalis, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Wynton Marsalis has a new book called Sweet Swing Blues on the Road. Here's music he composed for the film Tune In Tomorrow. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, news today of some of President Clinton's political problems. Many Democrats in Washington are concerned that the Whitewater investigation might cause more and more problems for President Clinton as 1996 approaches. And a new poll finds that a majority of Democrats think that President Clinton ought to be challenged for renomination in 96. Also on today's program, a report from the south side of Chicago, where many hold vigils to mark the deaths of children who were killed in crimes. And also Tom Gelton reports on day-to-day life in Sarajevo under siege.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has been busy making her Best of 1994 list, and it's a hefty one. So if you want to solve some of your holiday gift-giving problems, or want to buy some books to secretly stuff in your own stocking, grab a pen and paper and start writing.
I know what I'm asking Santa for this Christmas, Japanese lessons. I've just been introduced to Inspector Imanishi Aitaro, a middle-aged Tokyo police detective who writes haiku poetry and cultivates bonsai plants. Trouble is, if I want to spend more time in the company of Inspector Imanishi, I'm going to have to do my own translating. Soho Press has just reprinted in paperback Inspector Imanishi Investigates, an extraordinary 1961 mystery by Seiku Matsumoto. Master crime writer Matsumoto, I've recently learned, revived detective fiction in Japan following World War II, when the government there had banned mysteries as unpatriotic. But though Matsumoto wrote over 450 books, only one mystery has been translated into English. This is an intolerable situation. It's like having only one Sherlock Holmes story. To make matters more painful, Inspector Imanishi Investigates has one of the most ingenious murder plots I've ever encountered in a detective story. Please, publishing moguls, give me a reason to rejoice in 1995 and order more Matsumoto mysteries translated pronto. Now let's summon up the ghosts of blissful books past from 1994. Jane Hamilton's novel, A Map of the World, continues to haunt me with its tale of a woman who gets distracted for a minute while babysitting, just long enough for the little girl she's minding to drown. The chill of doom also riffles through Howard Norman's strange novel, The Bird Artist. Set in an isolated fishing village at the turn of the century, The Bird Artist tells the story of an arranged marriage, a tortured love affair, and the murder of the local lighthouse keeper. Along with what seems like half the planet, I trembled at The Alienist, Caleb Carr's ghoulish tale of murder in old New York. In The Alienist, Henry James meets Hannibal the Cannibal. I was mesmerized by Thomas Mallon's Henry and Clara, the semi-true story of a couple whose lives were shattered by the Lincoln assassination. And Alan Hollinghurst's The Folding Star eerily brightened my November evenings. This is an elegant Gothic novel about a gay Englishman who travels to an ancient Flemish city to become the tutor of a couple of teenage boys. Two works of criticism coming from opposite camps of the culture wars also deserve mention. In his massive, maddening, marvelous book, The Western Canon, Harold Bloom prescribes a list of literary masterworks from Shakespeare to Angels in America to help us avert the end of civilization as we know it. Susan J. Douglas's Where the Girls Are joyously rescues feminist and anti-feminist icons like the Shirelles and Cricket Blake from the dustbin of pop culture history. Now, for a quick dip into the year's assorted biographies and autobiographies. My sentimental favorite was Brooke Kroger's Nellie Bly, the incredible life story of America's first daredevil female reporter. Shari Benstock's No Gifts from Chance gave me an appreciation of the gutsy dame lurking under Edith Wharton's ladylike exterior. I also admired You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, history professor Howard Zinn's autobiography about his subversive politics of militant optimism, and Janet Malcolm's The Silent Woman about the clashing images of Sylvia Plath is simply the most astonishing and sinister reflection on the art of biography I've ever read. I've tried my best here, but this list doesn't even cover those books I liked a lot, with minor reservations, or those acclaimed but somehow still unread books gathering dust on my nightstand. Here's hoping for lots of snow days ahead so we can all catch up with our reading. You folks in the Sun Belt will have to invent your own excuse to stay home and read.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landrieu. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a new semi-autobiographical novel about an 8-year-old hemophiliac boy and his abusive father. We talk with Jim Grimsley about Winter Birds, the novel in which he says he became guardian angel to his younger self. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.